Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornelison, and you are listening to the web version of STEM Spots. And with me in the studio today is Dr. Sal Siniceros, who's the medical director of the Behavioral Medicine Clinic and the chief of psychiatry at the Jordan Valley Community Health Center here in Springfield. Thanks for stopping by, Sal.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Thank you.
So, Sal, we're going to talk about opioids today, which is something, I guess, near and dear to your heart, or at least you deal with it a lot. And the first thing I want to ask about is sort of the history. Now, we're going to gloss over the fact that there's been a problem with opioids in the United States and abroad, of course, since sometime in the 1800s, when there was sort of an opium to morphine to heroin to methadone kind of a thing that went on, and it was sort of illicit most of the time. And I'm interested instead in something you told me about that kind of started in 1990. Take us through that sort of brief but recent history.
Well, in 1990, there was a lady that was in a nursing home who happened to be dying from cancer. The family doctor started prescribing pain medications to alleviate her suffering. And as the patient passed away, the family felt as though they were not covering the pain medication enough or her pain enough. Subsequent to this, they sued him for malpractice and ended up winning, actually. Because of that, the AMA, other medical institutions, started taking on this aspect of treatment for pain. And it started with the sixth vital sign of pain. And that's when, like, when you go to the doctor and they ask you if your pain is from 0 to 10, and they actually mark that down as one of your typical vital signs. And that's when this all started. Because of that, the pharmaceutical companies started to realize that doctors were prescribing more and more pain medications because of this. And so they started to get into the act and started producing stronger and stronger pain medications. And along with that, they started to very heavily market their pain medication, where before a lot of these pain medications were generic, they started coming up with all these new type of medications that were stronger, longer acting, and they pushed and pushed and pushed as far as the marketplace was concerned. And unfortunately, that's what ended up leading to what we have now, which is, for a long time, a real heavy overuse of pain medication.
Now, who would have been involved in that? Presumably the FDA, but I'm surprised that also the DEA didn't get involved, because many of these that they were inventing or so forth must have had addictive properties, and therefore they were scheduled. Right, they must have been on the drug schedule of some kind or another. So, was there no pushback at all?
Not during that time. The FDA looked at efficacy and safety, and that was about it. The DEA, as long as they felt there was no significant problem at that point, they could care less. They were dealing with pot and cocaine and a bunch of other stuff.
Right. Right. And so this was something that went on until the current day. And people started really thinking about this. And so let's talk about this whole idea of epidemic, the current status of the problem. And you can first discuss a little bit about whether you believe it's an epidemic. And then let's talk a little bit about how it got to the point and what had to happen before people really started to open their eyes about this.
Well, it is an epidemic. And I think probably about 2 years ago, there were some studies done that indicated the amount of drug use in the United States, specifically opiate pain medications, was going higher and higher and higher and had peaked. And then they started looking at some pharmacies in West Virginia, some other rural places of Kentucky, where there were pharmacies that were dispensing more opiates than the whole city of New York could have used on a given day. And there were doctors that would have offices that by the time they opened up at 8 o'clock in the morning, there'd be a line of people waiting to get in. That's when they figured that, well, there's a real problem here. And then they started looking at the fact that there were more and more overdoses occurring. And that led to then this final realization that, in fact, there was a problem. Now, as a clinician, I started seeing this problem when I first got waivered to be able to prescribe a medication called buprenorphine. At that time, my waiver allowed me to prescribe maybe 30 patients at any given time. But as time progressed, I was running out of space. I had more and more people asking for this medication to treat their opiate addiction. Currently, I can treat up to 275, and I run to that limit on a regular basis.
Well, we'll talk more about that later because that's an interesting point. So it's an epidemic, and it seems like it cuts across all boundaries that you would typically think of with drug use. Is that true? I mean,
People that come into my clinic can be anywhere from executives at big corporations to people that are homeless and living underneath a bridge. I teach medical students, and they're sometimes surprised when we go into the room to see a new opioid-dependent patient and it's some lady that's dressed to the hilt. They always think it's going to be somebody that's dirty and homeless and has nothing, when in fact this person has everything.
We can talk about that a little bit because, when people think about drug use, they think about drug use driving you down into some sort of a gutterish situation. So, for example, I happen to be familiar for some reasons with meth. And with meth, there's sort of a classic kind of a thing. Skin and bones, lose your teeth, start to have all kinds of other problems, many times end up on the street. Can people function? So with the epidemic status of this, is this going to drive people long term, if they're not able to treat it, into a place that they really, really don't want to be? Or are there high functioning opioid addicts like there are high functioning, at least people claim, alcoholics?
There are some, but eventually in psychiatry, there's a thing called downward drift, where at some point, the support system for that person, their job, their family, or whatever, kind of gives up. And then they're stuck with having to go out to the street, where before they were able to go and get it at doctor's offices here and there, or they had a dealer that was giving them whatever because they had the money. But at some point, that kind of evaporates. And then that's when you start seeing that downward drift, where they go more and more to the streets and have to figure out, how am I going to get my fix for today?
And so the long-term consequences. So there's such a physical, we already know from things like alcohol abuse, severe alcohol abuse, there'll be cirrhosis. There can be all sorts of other related issues. And certainly with meth, there's widely understood that there's some negative consequences for the physical body. Opioids, is it just going to totally make you dependent, willing to do anything for it? Or is it going to also impact just your general overall health of your body? How will it affect that?
It affects your whole body eventually. What ends up happening is it starts causing cognitive problems. Your ability to think and reason start to diminish. You can also have problems with serious infections because eventually you're going to get stuff that's dirty and you're going to be shooting it up. I mean, I've had patients that shoot it up in their jugular vein, up in their neck, which is a direct conduit to their heart. And they can get very serious infections in that way. When they start losing the ability to shoot up in their veins, they start doing what's called skin popping. And so they end up with abscesses all over the place. And then above and beyond that, it takes its toll on the liver because the liver has to metabolize it just much like alcohol does.
Sure, sure. Now, when you think about the people talk about the usual suspects at a criminal element. So in this particular case, since the problem, as I understand it, isn't necessarily as significant in some other places, like let's say Europe, as it is here, then what is the set of usual suspects or culpable people, or whatever you want to call it, that have sort of created over the last 38 years or 28 years or something like that, this sort of environment that we're in? Drug companies participated at some level. Doctors? I mean, talk about that.
Well, much of it was driven by the pharmaceutical companies as far as their profit, their bottom line. But along with that, unfortunately, there have been physicians and clinics that must carry some of the blame because they saw the money also. They saw it was easy to have 35 patients an hour come in and just write scripts and charge them up front $20 a piece. That becomes a quite lucrative cash business for them. And physicians are like anybody else. There's good ones and there's ones that aren't so great and that don't have that moral, ethical issue that they require to be able to do this in the right way.
Okay. And so in Europe, talk a little bit about that. You mentioned something like they don't use nearly the level of this that we do.
Every single hydrocodone that's made in the world is used in the United States. None of it is used anywhere else in the world, nowhere in Europe, nowhere in Asia, nowhere in Latin America. Some of that has to do with the fact that by and large, the American population wants quick fixes. They don't want to feel anything as far as pain is concerned, and so they're willing to swallow whatever the doctor gives them. Part of it has to do in the way, the philosophy of the clinician and what he does to treat somebody. There's been many studies that show that medications like NSAIDs, which are totally innocuous, cover pain just as well as any narcotic. But the brain works in a funny way. And if you tell them, I'm going to give you a Tylenol for this, or I'm going to give you a Aleve for this, the brain says, oh, that's not going to be enough. My pain is worse. Where if you say, I'm going to give you a Percocet for this, and then the brain works in a different way.
That's very interesting. So now, we had discussed a little bit, what about this whole idea of stigma? So for a long, long time, people thought about drugs in different ways. There could be alcohol. Alcohol was well understood that a lot of your friends might use it, just something you're very familiar with. And then there were things like heroin, and you heard tales of heroin. And it was mostly back alley stuff, people with a needle in their arm, lower forms of life, as many people sort of looked at it. So there's a stigma attached for a long time to opioids. And now, does that stigma still, is it still there? How do people feel about this? Does it affect people's willingness to look upon this as a problem in their own lives? How does that work?
There still is somewhat of a stigma. Actually, a pretty definitive amount of stigma with this. Unfortunately, many people think of this as a moral issue, when in fact it's a medical issue. I always use the comparison between opioid addiction and diabetes. I had a medical student who said, well, when this patient comes in dirty, are you going to fire them? And I said, well, no, because that would be the same as if they came in with blood sugars that are out of whack and I fired them for that. It's a disease and we need to treat it. Luckily, here recently with the outbreak of the publicity as far as the opioid epidemic, that's changing somewhat. But there's still a ways to go. The judicial system still thinks of this as being a moral issue and wants to put people in jail rather than treatment. The emergency rooms treat this as a moral issue and want to throw these patients out or will do feed into the problem and give them more pain medications than they really need. Clinicians other than those in mental health will treat this as a moral issue and just don't want to deal with these patients.
So let's say people have some sort of an event that sort of drags them into this. They're not using anything particularly. They have an accident. They're in extreme pain. Somebody prescribes something like this for them. Is it truly easy for them to become addicted to it? Because, you know, most people, when they think about addiction, they think, yeah, you know, you use something a long time and you got addicted. It's kind of your fault. But it sounds like this can happen pretty quickly. Is that true?
Yeah, that's so. What happens is that we have something called polymorphisms, which are genetic sequencings that are a little bit off. We all have them. That's what produces baldness in some people or heart disease in others. For some people, it produces addiction issues, especially addiction to opiates. And so they just need to be on an opiate for 3 to 5 days and they're hooked. What ends up happening is that no longer is it a pain issue for them, it's a pleasure issue because their pleasure centers are dampened, they don't work well, and then all of a sudden they take this Percocet or whatever and they start to feel pleasure. And so like any human, they're going to continue craving that it's sensation.
And of course, you mentioned a moral issue, and I've heard this talked about before, even when it comes to something like marijuana, where I've heard people describe people's behavior as an affront to society. Addiction is typically not driven by any kind of link to a person's willingness to confront society. Isn't it mostly coming from within? It's not. A lot of people would think you're shaking your fist at society to do these sorts of things because you're committing a crime, perhaps. And people don't look at it that way. They're what, self-medicating? They're trying to find solutions in their own life?
Yeah, it's a couple of things. First of all, it's not that they're shaking their fist at society. Society is actually shaking their fist at them, and that's why they lack access. That's number one. Number two, generally, about 85% of these people have underlying psychiatric problems, depression, bipolar disorder, et cetera, that kind of drive this along because they need to self-medicate if they want to have some kind of function. So they start taking these drugs because they're much easier access to these drugs than there is to seeing a psychiatrist or some other behavioral provider.
And so when you think about intervention, because obviously you deal with that, you're a psychiatrist, so you can prescribe medication, but you also can try to deal with this in other ways too. So talk to us about medication, because you mentioned the fact that there's this particular drug that you're allowed to prescribe. So talk about that drug. I don't think it itself is a narcotic. So then I'm curious as to why only certain people can dispense that drug and why there are caps on the dispensing of that drug. You know what I'm talking about. So talk about that as the first line of the intervention strategy.
Well, the drug that you're talking about is called buprenorphine. And basically, it's a opioid antagonist, which means that it actually blocks the opioid receptor, keeps the person from going through withdrawal, but also stops all the cravings so they don't feel as though they have to get their necks fixed. Unfortunately, somewhere along the line, somebody decided that there needed to be caps on people that were waivered to be able to prescribe this. Initially, the cap was 40 patients for a group of physicians. Then it went up to 30 individuals per physician, then to 100. Now, most recently, it's 275. But I can tell you from my own practice that it could be 500 and I would still not have room for people coming
now,
in.
Now, what kind of a weird justification is that? Is it an FDA decision? Is it a bureaucrat in some little room that made this decision? And what could possibly be the argument? The argument that people are weak? And if you give them this stuff, they'll just what? I don't get it. I'm not sure.
I don't get it either, because it's actually a Schedule 3, which is a schedule lower than a narcotic is, which means that I can call it in for somebody and give them refills. I can't do that with a narcotic. It's not a DEA thing. They're the ones that made it to Schedule 3, so they felt it was not as problematic as Percocet, let's say. It's got to be a bureaucratic issue where somewhere along the line people thought that, well, there isn't that many people, this is enough, or these people are dirty anyway, who really cares, we'll just keep it at this number. I really don't know.
So with the intervention, you try to get them on something like this and to relieve them of the cravings for the opioids. Now, what about the pain part?
Well, because of the mechanism in which it works, it actually is used sometimes as a pain medication. It can help in that arena, albeit not as strong as morphine sulfate or oxycodone. It certainly can be dramatic how much better somebody can feel. That's the main issue as far as pain is concerned. In a lot of places in Europe, that's the drug of choice postoperatively. Instead of giving them Dilaudid or Percocets or whatever, they give them buprenorphine to cover the pain until they can switch them over to an NSAID.
Right. And so, okay, so now let's go to the next step. You got the pain covered in some way, shape, or form, even though it's hard to prescribe for everybody a little bit. And you've got the addiction craving, perhaps. So they're not going to have what you would consider classical withdrawal symptoms. But yet, there's more to it than that. They have to work out issues of some kind or another. So talk about the issues that they have to work through if they really truly want to get off of this stuff.
Well, the first part that you were talking about, that's the physical issues.
Right.
The second part is the psychological issues. Now we got to start, once they're done with that problem, and then the next issue that we have to do is the psychosocial issues. Do they have an underlying psychiatric problem that needs to be taken care of? Do they have enough money to be able to feed their children and themselves? Do they have a home? Is their relationship functioning? I tell my people when they feel as though, well, how long do I have to be on this medication? I always tell them, you only need to be on it until your life is perfect. At that point, we'll be happy to get you off of it.
Sure.
Because there's always going to be triggers. There's always going to be issues that lead that addiction mentality to use again unless they have that buffer with the medication. So our next step after we stabilize them in that way is to get them into, at Jordan Valley, we have groups and individual therapy that we get them into to start that process of getting them insight into what their problem is and to start to help them to deal with these problems. Obviously, we don't have a pill that's going to change that, but we do have techniques to help them be able to get through those things.
So let's talk about not just stigma, but let's talk about strategies as they relate to class, as they relate to socioeconomic class and things like that. So how much of a recidivism and how much of a relapse how does that link? Do you see correlations? If people have a strong socioeconomic status and a strong support system, are they less likely to relapse? Have you thought about that kind of stuff? Do people know about that?
Yeah. It ends up being that those who have a better support system are less likely to relapse because they have more responsibility. And they think about that responsibility. They get insight into the fact that they do have these responsibilities and I can't go back down that road again. That doesn't mean that they don't relapse, but the incidence of relapse is going to be less. Those people that are suffering under significant psychosocial stressors that maybe don't have transportation to get to the clinic, maybe don't, they're on
food stamps
and they cut their food stamps off or whatever, they're going to have much more stressors. And so, again, that addiction mind is going to think back, I can't deal with this, I got to use. That's my mechanism of getting out of this situation.
So are those avenues with through the doctors being severely curtailed now? Is that true? Does that mean that the likelihood is the more people are going to spill over into street usage? Is that what's likely to happen, since people have been talking pretty harshly about trying to draw back the prescription part of this?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's exactly the case that's going on. You know, the DEA and the Center for Disease Control has indicated that physicians can't give any more than X amount of medication to anybody as far as pain management is concerned. Unfortunately, that doesn't always work. And so there's a spillover, a considerable percentage of people that it's not covering their pain very adequately. And so they're going to go back to using in the street, especially if their tendency was to overuse to begin with.
So I mean, when you see people that go down this path to start with, I'm just curious because this is sort of a related issue. If you look at people and you try to get their life story in order, is it usually a catastrophic incidence of something, car accident, injury at work, or are we talking that people go down this path more times because of chronic issues, chronic lower back pain, chronic something due to another kind of a disease or something like that?
Actually, the number one prescribers of opiates are dentists.
Holy moly. another reason not
to
go.
And that's a lot of times that's what ends up happening, because a dentist, you have a procedure done, dentist gives them pain medications that maybe they don't really need. But that triggers that polymorphism we were talking about, and then they have the addiction. Now they can't go to the dentist because they don't have any more dental caries, so they go to the emergency room and say, oh, I'm passing a kidney stone, or I'm having a low back problem, and start doctor shopping or ER shopping to try to get the medications.
Now, that's very interesting, because you must have looked at that, because people that are – when you talk about all across the spectrum of behavior, all across the spectrum of class, socioeconomic class, all or responsibility level, you would typically think that people at higher levels of responsibility who have their life more put together, let's call it, would be less likely than to do something that most of us would look down our nose at, which would be doctor shopping. But do they find themselves in that position and they do it anyway?
Sure. I mean, they have to get it somewhere. And the only difference is that they present themselves a whole lot better. So that makes it easier for them to get their medication when doctor shopping or going to the emergency room. That's that stigma again. If you go in wearing a coat and tie to the emergency room and indicate that you've got this terrible migraine headache and the only thing that works is Percocets, they're much more likely to give you that than you come in all scruffy and smelling bad to give you that same medication.
That's very interesting. Well, you know, we've talked about a whole bunch of different things, and it's fascinating. And of course, the last thing I'll follow up with was, do you think the problem is likely to get better? Is it just going to sort of stabilize and stay at some percentage of the populace and it's gotten as bad as it can be, or is it going to dramatically get better, do you think?
It's not going to dramatically get better. And I don't think it's going to stay the same. I think it's going to get worse over time. And I say that with a lot of sadness because, you know, I spend much of my day trying to treat this. But the problem is too multifaceted. The answer doesn't lie with medication. The answer doesn't lie with psychotherapy. The answer doesn't lie with this or with that. It lies with a whole bunch of stuff. And a lot of it's things that I as a clinician can't do anything about. First and foremost, we have no access. We have people that line up to try to get a spot with me because there's just nobody that provides this service in the city. So that's the biggest issue. And so that's only what's going to happen to them. They try, but they can't get it. They can't get in. They can't see anybody. So they go back to using. Eventually, they give up. Eventually, they overdose and die.
Wow. And also, I'll follow up. The last thing I'll ask is with all these things, and I'm not sure if fentanyl actually qualifies in this class of drugs at all, but is the overdose, when you think about deaths and you think about fundamentally terrible outcomes, are there more of those in illicit or are there more of those with prescription?
Well, it's actually illicit, but it is fentanyl, because remember that fentanyl these days is very cheap to make, much cheaper than heroin. So easy to buy, cheap to buy. It's made in China and in Mexico, comes over a lot. You don't need to very much to be able to cut it to give people. And they're even, these days, they're even putting it on, sprinkling it into a pot. And so when you smoke marijuana, the most likely thing is you're going to get a hit of fentanyl with it too. And if you've not been an opiate user, that fentanyl can very easily kill you. It is 50 times stronger than heroin.
Holy crap. Was that invented for a legitimate purpose to begin with?
It was invented. It was invented for the treatment of cancer pain, which can be very, very severe. But unfortunately, it turned out to be such an easy thing to produce that it's being produced illicitly all over the world.
Well, I didn't hope to hear that answer, so I'm sorry to hear it. Sal, thanks so much for stopping by and talking to us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And once again, this is Dave Cornelison for STEM Spots, signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.